good morning and welcome to MTSU On The Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. With the diversification of the political workplace, more people of different ethnic backgrounds and more women rising to positions of power, both elected and appointed, and the election of the first African-American president, will the way that the news media deal with race and gender issues change substantially? And here to talk about that today are Dr. Jennifer Woodard and Dr. Claire Bratton from the Department of Electronic Media Communication. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Let's go back to the 2008 campaign for a minute and look at the way the Obama campaign, Robert Gibbs is a top Obama aide who has now become his presidential press secretary. The way the Obama campaign dealt with reporters and treated reporters, was it substantial in helping him to become elected president?
I think it was. I think one of the things that he did really well was he maintained distance from the press so that they really couldn't get a peg on him, and they couldn't create the traditional stereotypes around a character that they normally would when you're in a presidential campaign. They like to try and create a characterization of you. And I think because he kept such distance between them and was very careful of how he presented himself to the media, he's very media savvy. I think this enabled him to control how he was going to be portrayed in the media.
And by comparison to, say, John McCain welcoming everybody on the Straight Talk Express, for example, and being very chummy?
Yes, I think it made quite a difference because it also added to his air of mystery. He wasn't one of the boys, and it also made him seem more serious, that he was taking this stuff very serious because he's not engaging with us. He won't let us get close because he's so busy.
Mm-hmm. Was there a substantial difference between the way he conducted his media campaign and the way, say, Jesse Jackson, or in a more contemporary sense, Al Sharpton, who had access to, you know, new technology that Jackson did not in the 1980s, run their campaigns?
Well, I'd say definitely, this is Claire, I would say that obviously Obama used and his people used new media in a way that was very effective, and their target market was more specifically urban, young, and not necessarily just African American. It was also progressive young liberals who were white as well, and so the new media was particularly effective in targeting them, and I don't know that Al Sharpton, for example, would have used a similar approach because I don't think he probably viewed his constituency in the same way. Jennifer?
Yeah, and I think that Barack Obama is more savvy in some ways about how race is going to be portrayed, and he was very careful and how he was going to be portrayed by the media race-wise. And I think by using new technology and not really focusing in on his race, not really running on a so-called African-American or a black platform, mm-hmm. which is what you saw Jesse Jackson did, I think this enabled more people to come onto his program and say, yeah, this guy is different. He's not all about race. He really wants to talk about the issues. Whereas Jesse Jackson and Sharpton had been such iconic figures of the struggle from the civil rights era that they could never really shake that sense that I'm more black than anything else. Whereas with Barack Obama, it was more like I'm a man first, and then I'm black, and I'm also, by the way, biracial.
Mm-hmm. Some people opined at one point in the campaign that the fact that his father was Kenyan and his mother white might actually have caused him difficulty in the black community because he was not connected to the African-American lineage that came about from the slave history of the United States, that was not part of his family tree, as it were. There are all kinds of different directions that this went off into. There were, as a matter of fact, the Obama campaign put up a website at one point to debunk certain myths. that he was a Muslim, that he wasn't really born in this country. So how do things like this get traction? Is it talk radio? Is it the blogosphere? How do these things get injected into the dialogue?
Well, I'll comment on that. This is Claire again. I think that the blogosphere and beyond that, email, has an amazing ability to do demagoguery in the way that, you know, say older forms of perhaps virulent speaking or even talk radio. I think that email, it was astonishing to me the amount of hate mail, basically. I'll characterize it that way, or mischaracterization, misinformation. I got lots of it forwarded to me from people in my family who are more conservative, and I would routinely go to Snopes.com, which is a site where you can check on whether something that you've received is actually based on fact or fiction. They're really good at sort of debunking urban myths, and you know, from whether you know there's something evil in your peanut butter to you know a political campaign. So. And it was interesting that after a while, if I did respond to a list that had, you know, some kind of disinformation or misinformation on it, that I noticed that some of these people, and I have to say a lot of them were older family members, you know, would started checking in on Snopes.com, which I was sort of thrilled that, you know, I could do a little intervention there. But I do think that email is, it's the magnitude of which it spreads rumors and hate kinds of messages is pretty astonishing and worrying.
Did you ask yourself, how the hell did I end up on these jokers' email list in the first place?
Oh, I know how. So that's unfortunately, it seems like in every family, there's going to be somebody who disagrees with you politically, oh, and they're going forward these sort of things.
I see.
In fact, my brother-in-law and I had to agree to no longer forward things to each other because we were on opposite sides of the spectrum politically.
And it became really
irritating.
We
just decided to call a truce. You know?
I guess I want to address the other part of the question about blackness and who gets to define what blackness is. What makes an authentic black person?
Yes.
I think for too long, entertainment television and rap videos and have been defining what is authentic blackness. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be that you can't be educated and you have to wear sloppy clothes and you have to do all these, there's like this list of things mm-hmm. that define blackness that's being told and taught to the public. But the last time I checked, the only thing that made you black, and blackness is race, mm-hmm. is the color of your skin. That's what race is. Race is purely skin color. Mm-hmm. So for all of these hip-hop definitions to be applied to a definition of blackness, or were your parents slaves, or this, that, mm-hmm. or the other, that's completely bogus, and it's complete misinformation. So I think I like the way that Barack Obama, by being front and center in the media, is redefining and opening the boundaries of what blackness can be. I mean, he's actually bringing a new sense of pride that used to be before the advent of the 90s and music videos, and I'll probably catch a lot of flack for this, mm-hmm. but I think blackness was defined much more broadly. Mm-hmm. And I think that Barack Obama is redefining those boundaries and allowing for a new sense of pride and being a new role model mm-hmm. that children can look up to, both black and white, and all other races. I mean, he's redefining who you can be. And so you don't have to be trapped by these stereotypes. You can be whoever you say you want to be.
Now, why do we even ask the question? Why do we even ask the question?
Because I think it's just like, goes back to what Claire says. If you can divide the black community on Barack Obama, then you can divide the vote. Mm-hmm. And Barack Obama was gathering up a lot of speed and a lot of support within the black community. And so if you can put out the disinformation that he's not black enough or he's not black like you, then perhaps you can get that community not to vote for him or to buy into that if you apply enough pressure.
Mm-hmm. Some people have complained that the news media in general don't discuss race frankly enough. There was a series on CNN where Paula Zahn, for a limited period of time, tried to hold nightly discussions, nightly national seances on the subject. Roland Martin has since been added as a contributor to CNN. Is it generating more heat than light, or are we getting anywhere?
I think that with Barack Obama, I think that you really can say that there's a new sense of hope with minorities, all minorities, because of the way he's been able to redefine himself and escape those set boundaries of stereotypes, of negative stereotypes. I think that the news media has to pay attention to the issue of race, and they have to pay attention to it in a more nuanced way than they used to, because he defies all of the traditional stereotypes. So you have to, and there are a lot of people saying, that's me too, that's mm-hmm. my background, I did that way too, hey, I'm biracial too, or hey, I'm Harvard educated, and I've been looking for somebody to say, I'm black too.
Mm-hmm. Or I'm an immigrant.
Yes.
Or the son of immigrants.
Yes, and look what I've been able to do.
Right. I think it's interesting that he also grew up in Hawaii, which is a multiracial, much more nuanced society, mm-hmm. I would mm-hmm. say. For me, that, you know, it seemed to color my perception of his roots as being, you know, much more diverse and complicated. He's a complicated person. I mean, in communications theory, we talk about somebody being, it's almost like a sign, it's called a signifier. So there are certain connotations, like if you think of apple pie as, you know, America's baseball apple pie. Well, if you think about the connotations with Barack Obama, there are so many. It's just not, he defies easy categorization, which is what I think Jennifer is saying.
Yeah. And yet when he and Michelle do a fist bump on the campaign tour, people have mm-hmm. a conniption fit.
Right, but they got over it. I mean, he still was elected.
Well, except for that one magazine, apparently, The New Yorker, that it was really interesting the way they tried to characterize them as terrorists after one very innocent and affectionate fist bump. I don't even know what this fist bump was supposed to mean. It's not like it's a traditional characteristic in the black community that we go around bumping fists. So I thought that was really interesting that the media tried to make this into a really mm-hmm. racialized type of moment when it was just a special moment between the two of them that had nothing to do with black culture, truly. Well, it wasn't a fist raised in the air.
Yeah. Well, the New Yorker cartoon was really, cover cartoon was really interesting because they're known for their satirical cartoons. And mm-hmm. their spin was that we were making fun of all of these cretins who were trying to characterize the Obamas as this, that, or the other. Mm-hmm. But not everybody who looked at the cartoon saw it in that ironic kind of way. It was perceived differently in different
places. It's like Archie Bunker.
Yeah.
You know. Archie Bunker was designed to be a satire to show how racism is and bigotry is in the United States, but people actually got on board and said, hey, yeah, I'm just like Archie. Way to go, Archie. Way to speak up for all of us, instead of them taking it as the satire that it was. I think that same thing happened with that cartoon. Mm-hmm.
With regard to women, particularly Hillary Clinton, it's like women candidates are almost facing the kind of thing that contemporary first ladies, at least since Eleanor Roosevelt, have faced. You're too strong, you get slammed.
Mm-hmm.
You're too feminine, you get slammed.
Yes.
You can't be all things to all people. You might as well be yourself, and if you are yourself, well, you might not get elected anyway. What is a woman candidate for public office to do?
Wow.
Good question, because what we saw with Hillary Clinton was if she cried, that was either a phony moment or evidence of weakness. If she was too strong or too aggressive, then she was the B word. And then mm-hmm. if mm-hmm. she you tried to counter that by wearing, you know, a lower cut outfit, what'd you call it, cleavage gate?
Yeah, it was cleavage gate. And there was just barely a hint of cleavage.
I know.
Mean, and the media went crazy.
Yeah.
It was completely ridiculous. And you see way more explicit things on the red carpet.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So a female candidate has to walk a very balanced line. I don't know exactly what a woman has to do in order to become president. It's really quite horrendous the way the media and people in general commented and treated her, and Sarah Palin for that matter. Sarah Palin was made into a joke. A joke. I mean, she was obviously a very intelligent woman, but she was made into a complete character. And I thought that was horrible.
But did she not contribute to her own demise with her rather incomplete answers to some rather simple questions?
Yes, she did, but at the same time, it was extreme. I think the SNL representations and people were really taking the Saturday Night Live and all of those other satires seriously and getting their news and information from these stations as if this were reality and not a satire, which goes back to the problem of the Village Voice.
You mean the New
climate,
Yorker?
Yeah, the New Yorker. I'm so sorry. But in today's society, it seems to me that people are getting their news from these satirical commentaries as opposed to getting their news from the news media. There seems to be a blurring of the line, and I think that's not acceptable.
Well, I have to speak up in defense of the satirical sources because under the last administration, when the March to War banners were all over the 24/7 news channels, it just seemed like a fait accompli before you even, you know, the war even began. It was, the drumbeat was very loud, and all of this pressure on people to be patriotic and you must not oppose it. And the only place where you found any criticism that was routinely aired were on these comedy shows. And I think that in the first Gulf War, the media was accused of, you know, having it be like a video game war, and, mm-hmm. and like they were too quick to get on board, and then the media went through a big mea culpa after the end of the first Gulf War. It was like, oh, we were co-opted, we really need to do something. And they tried to do something with the second one where they mm-hmm. went, you know, embedded, but that had its own problems too. And I do think that the comedy, yes, that you have to take it all with a grain of salt, but I do think that it actually was the only news outlet that, other than certain progressive news outlets like Democracy Now, and there's certain
The Nation,
you know, Free Speech TV, and The Nation magazine.
But don't you think they're harder on women candidates than they are on anybody else, these satirical expressions?
Probably. I hadn't really thought about that. But
I think truly, and Sarah Palin did bring a lot of things on herself. She did.
She did.
But I think that the satire, satirical representations of her, really cost McCain-Palin ticket the election.
Well, they were also satirizing Hillary Clinton, as I recall, and you know.
And I think that helped her lose the Democratic nomination to Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. I really think it did.
Even during the Clinton administration, I heard more and saw on the internet more ugly jokes about it. It's like maybe homosexuality is the last frontier, because there were calling Hillary Clinton a lesbian or implying that she was a lesbian in the blogosphere was supposed to be the epitome of the insult, the worst thing that you could throw at her. And that's the old saw, you know, if you mm-hmm. if you want to make a woman feel really bad, we'll just call her a lesbian or imply that she's a lesbian instead of accepting the fact that it's not bad to be a lesbian.
Yes.
To that end, with regard to gender and gender construction in the media, what kind of a job are the news media, do you think, doing covering gay rights issues?
Not a very good one. Not a very good one.
It's hard for me to respond completely because I tend to watch some the more you know, progressive sources, and I think that they do try to cover it. But, you know, mainstream, it's very fraught. I would say that it's probably not very favorable at all.
Is it because there is something sinister afoot, or is it just ignorance?
Well, I think there are some very strong beliefs, sometimes rooted in religious beliefs and convictions, that where people have maybe even thought about it, you know, that it's not just a ignorance thing. I mean, they have a strong belief about what is right, and in their view, they have a certain definition of what falls within and without the...
It's different, this particular ism, than with racism and sexism. And it's different because you start adding in all of the religious thoughts and ideas, and that's much harder for the media to tackle because it's just so fraught with what's going to happen if we put the story this way, how is our audience going to react? If we put the story this way, how is our audience going to react? And I just don't know that the audience, that the news media, the mainstream news media, even knows how to handle this issue yet. I think they're trying, but they haven't gotten a peg on how to phrase it objectively and in a way that their audience will accept. I see a lot of talk shows starting to address it. But that's one of the barometers for me, is you can see it. It will move from the talk show into the media room, into the newsroom. But it hasn't quite made that move completely yet.
And yet we do have, you know, like Ellen, who's openly
right
gay. And
that's how you can measure the barometer with the talk shows. And Oprah is doing a lot of talk about homosexuality and those types of issues on her shows recently. And offending a lot of her public. You're seeing a lot on the blogosphere that people are angry about it, which is interesting. They'll accept anything from Oprah except this particular issue.
Has media consolidation and the drive for ratings had an impact on how race and gender issues get covered by journalists?
I would say so. I mean, if for no other reason that one of the biggest enterprises, Fox News, is owned by Rupert Murdoch, and it's a huge conglomeration, and there are actual political directives that come down from senior management, so they actually do shape the news quite conservatively, and they have certain topics that they will cover or will not, and
talking points for reporters
in a way, and you know, somebody might argue that the same thing is going on at MSNBC, but I don't know that that's true from the top down. I do know that they have found themselves a niche, you know, where Rachel Maddow is actually an openly lesbian woman, and that there are a more progressive point of view that seems to be circulating on that particular network, but I don't know if that comes from the top down in the same way that it does at Fox. But certainly media consolidation does seem to limit, if you've got a corporate view, it's going to limit what kinds of views are expressed. If you have 25 media outlets, and that means all 25 are going to be representing that one corporate point of view.
Not only does it limit, there's a lot of power there. Not only can you control the media, you can control the publishing, you can control the movies and the commercials. That's very powerful. Media conglomeration and the way that they're all being bought out by one or two or three big companies, that makes the company at the top a very powerful voice for controlling what you hear in the media. They choose to exert that power. They don't all choose to exert that power. But I think it's something that we all need to keep at the backs of our heads, that they could all become like Fox and start sending down corporate directives. And then, if that's the only place we're getting our news from, are from these sources and these outlets they control, they control your thoughts.
Is it all as direct as the Fox approach of sending down talking points from on high, or is it more a corporate culture, more nuanced kind of, for lack of a better expression, peer pressure?
Well, I think there is a newsroom culture that has existed traditionally, and I think that there's evidence. I mean, there's actually been studies that prove that there is self-editing that goes on among reporters where they know they're, I don't even bother to write this story, or don't even bother to interview this person or lead with this example because it's going to be edited. And so rather than, go up against, once up against the ramparts, they go ahead and just edit themselves. So they write the story in a way they know it will be acceptable. It's just more expedient. Everybody's pressed for time. And so I do think there are practices. I do think that in a way the blogosphere has pushed its way into the conversation, though, by bringing up opposite points.
Mm-hmm. I think the blogosphere, the internet, that's where you're seeing the new activism. Mm-hmm. And it's not just people speaking, which is what I tell my class. Just writing about it isn't enough. There has to be some move to action. And I believe that the internet is becoming a rallying point for activism. Mm-hmm. And it's a place where people can meet from all different places. They can plan and they can all move at once. They can all do their letter writing. They can put out the addresses where they need to write to their congressman. They can have the links. So it makes it easier to be an activist online. Which is way different from sitting in front of your TV and just watching something and then having to actively go get up and turn on something and then write the letter. You can do it at the same moment that you see it, you can respond.
So has the internet become the new, Richard Viguerie used to be the Republican Party's main man for direct mail campaigns via snail mail. Has the internet become the new device for this, and if it can be used for grassroots activism, it can certainly be used for corporate lobbying, and it's very egalitarian and unregulated at this point.
Certainly.
Well, you definitely saw Barack Obama using the internet and the blogs and even making announcements on the internet before he announced it anywhere else. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely something that everyone has to take into account now. Okay. New media is here, and you have to take into account, and you have to learn how to properly utilize it because it's a very powerful entity.
I do think that, this could be my own rebellious spirit speaking here, but if a giant corporation wants to influence my thoughts and they send me a bunch of, emails or, say, oh, go to this link, I'm not going to buy it the same way that I would, an activist organization. There's something, I think that Americans are pretty smart and that they know when the corporate interest is behind a message. And we can enjoy it. I mean, we can enjoy watching a giant brewery, have a beer commercial that we think is funny, or something like that. But I think that there is a distinction if you know who's sending the message. And,
Its band becomes the equivalent of white noise, and you just, it becomes reflexive that you know where to click delete and where not to click delete and what to tune out.
And so I suppose I think maybe the, potential for corporate, control would be if they start underwriting campaigns that appear to be grassroots when in fact aren't. And in fact, in Nashville recently, there was a vote on whether English would be the official language, and it was voted down. And then soon after that vote, it became evident that that the campaign had been mostly financed by one conservative organization out of Virginia. And so it was not a grassroots effort, really.
But the web is getting ready to evolve and change again. And there are going to be a lot more tighter controls by corporations and the government on this new web. So the web is getting ready to evolve, and they're working, corporations are working earnestly trying to control what was uncontrollable.
We will have to leave it there. We are running out of time. Dr. Claire Bratton, Dr. Jennifer Woodard, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
This is MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Loeb. Join us again at the same time next Sunday.